Today is Wednesday, January 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the Senate impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump got underway Tuesday afternoon in Washington.
Today, we will consider and pass an organizing resolution that will structure the first phase of the trial.
Plus, the death toll from the coronavirus outbreak in China climbed on Tuesday, and the U.S. confirmed its first case. And North Korea says unless sanctions are removed, it may chart a new path. Those stories and more are next. The impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump got underway Tuesday afternoon in Washington, with the Democrats' Adam Schiff starting things off.
Astonishingly, the president's trial brief filed yesterday contends that even if this conduct is proved, that there is nothing that the House or this Senate may do about it. It is the president's apparent belief that under Article 2, he can do anything he wants, no matter how corrupt.
After his opening remarks, the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, spoke on behalf of President Trump.
We believe that once you hear those initial presentations, the only conclusion will be that the president has done absolutely nothing wrong, and that these articles of impeachment do not begin to approach the standard required by the Constitution.
Now, after some last-minute tweaks on Tuesday, the proposed rules for President Trump's impeachment now largely mirrors the ones used for the trial of former President Bill Clinton. The Senate currently is debating additional amendments into the evening. Now, earlier I spoke with Ilya Sumet, a law professor at Georgetown University's Center for the Constitution, about the impeachment process.
When it comes to the impeachment proceedings, the Constitution is fairly vague. It says the House has the power to impeach, the Senate has the power to try, and that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court has the power to preside. Why wasn't this the ultimate political tool to remove a president from office written out in clearer and more specific language?
I think for a couple reasons. One is that there is also a provision in the Constitution which says that each House of Congress has the power to set the rules for its own proceedings. So it was foreseen that the Senate itself would create the rules, or at least most of them, for Senate trials. A second reason why the framers may not have felt the need to specify much in the way of rules is that they did not expect the rise of political parties to occur, and therefore didn't expect senators to be as partisan as most of them actually are. And they even thought that the Senate would in some ways be above the fray of ordinary politics.
You brought up the partisan nature of politics in the United States. Does that present a problem, not only for this impeachment trial, which is very partisan across the lines, does that create a problem in creating an objective environment to carry out this solemn task?
It absolutely creates a problem, not just in this impeachment, but every other impeachment or attempted impeachment of a president that we've had. There has been a great deal of partisanship involved. Obviously, the partisan opponents of the president often tend to favor impeachment, whereas his supporters tend to oppose it. And more fundamentally, there is some conflict between the idea of a trial where the people making the decision on conviction are at least supposed to be impartial in principle, and the partisan setup that we actually have, where all or nearly all of the senators are partisans of one of the two major parties, and they have strong political incentives often to either support the president or oppose him.
You bring up an interesting point there. You know, they have political motives to go one way or the other. This is playing out on national television, and this is an election year. So all the senators took an oath to be unbiased, to be impartial. But with it being an election year, and, you know, what does that mean in terms of their being able to do their job, but also being essentially worried about being reelected?
So I think as a practical matter, very few of them are actually going to be genuinely impartial. I don't think they're completely incapable of doing so, but I think it's rare for politicians in a context like this to truly set partisan politics aside, and I think as a practical matter, most of them will barely even attempt to do so.
And we've seen a number of Republicans and Democrats come out on television, on radio shows, espousing their personal views ahead of the trial, before any evidence, even that which was collected during the House impeachment inquiry, being presented in the Senate. Is that a problem in terms of having this Senate trial appear objective and impartial?
I think it's a problem, but it's an almost unavoidable problem because unlike a normal jury in a criminal or civil case where they're generally selected for not having, you know, prior knowledge of the case and or the people involved, in this instance, these people clearly, you know, have seen just all of the rest of us, just like all the rest of us have. They've seen the evidence presented in the House. They've seen the history of this play out on national TV. And, of course, all or nearly all of them already have some clear opinion of, you know, Donald Trump.
That was Ilya Selman, a law professor at Georgetown University. The death toll from the coronavirus outbreak in China climbed on Tuesday as authorities reported a surge in new cases, with fears that hundreds of millions of people traveling for the Lunar New Year holiday will accelerate the infection rate. Reuters' Lauren Anthony has more.
Chinese authorities have confirmed that the outbreak of a deadly new virus could be spread through human contact. Hundreds have contracted the virus over the last few days. Medical staff have been infected and several people have died. A chilling update on the coronavirus, which began in Wuhan, a city of 11 million people. The majority of infections have been detected in China, but the virus has already spread to other countries, including Thailand, Japan, South Korea and the Philippines, as millions travel for the Lunar New Year holiday. Scientists in Hong Kong have warned of the super spreader disease, and authorities are adamant the virus will be brought under control. The health scare has brought back bad memories of SARS, another coronavirus that broke out in China in the early 2000s, which killed nearly 800 in a global pandemic. Health authorities across the globe have stepped up their screening of travelers arriving from China, and some Chinese pharmacies have even run out of face masks as people stock up ahead of the Lunar New Year holiday. The origin of the virus is yet to be identified, but the World Health Organization suspects the primary source to be animal. Chinese officials have said they've linked the outbreak to a seafood market in Wuhan. The virus can cause pneumonia, and symptoms include fever and difficulty in breathing. The outbreak has also sent shivers through financial markets. The WHO called a meeting for Wednesday to consider declaring an international health emergency.
That was Reuters reporter Lauren Anthony. And China has reported the number of cases up to 440 individuals with 9 deaths. Health screenings for the virus are underway at 3 U.S. airports, New York's Kennedy Airport, and in California at San Francisco and Los Angeles airports. Chicago and Atlanta airports are expected to get similar screenings later this week. The U.S., which reported its first case of the virus on Tuesday, will also route all Wuhan-originating passengers to those 5 airports. In a teleconference with reporters, Washington State epidemiologist Dr. Scott Lindquist says the U.S. resident diagnosed with the new coronavirus had a high level of concern after traveling from the Wuhan, China area.
He came in before that screening was done and was actually not with symptoms when he came into the United States. But this was a very astute gentleman that is looking at internet activity and actually had researched this and shared this information with his provider.
Snohomish County Health Officer Dr. Chris Bitters also says the patient is in good condition, hospitalized in isolation.
The Snohomish Health District coordinated with the Snohomish County Emergency Medical System to safely transport the patient to Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett. That facility is following our jointly developed infectious disease protocols to ensure prevention of transmission in the facility.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said it developed a test to detect the new coronavirus and plans to share the tool with domestic and international partners. North Korea on Tuesday said that as the United States has ignored its year-end deadline for nuclear talks, it no longer felt bound by commitments, which included a halt to its nuclear testing and firing of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Speaking as the envoy from the People's Democratic Republic of Korea, or DPRK, Ju Yong-chol accused the United States of applying, quote, the most brutal and inhumane sanctions, adding, if the U.S. persists in such a hostile policy toward the DPRK, there will never be the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. End quote. Now, to break things down on what this may mean for North Korea, the United States, and the rest of the world in 2020, I spoke earlier with Bruce Klinger, Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation.
It's really a continuation of North Korean remarks, particularly those that Kim Jong-un made to the party plenum. And in really, in some cases, he was just repeating verbatim what Kim had said. So it's not a change in North Korean strategy or policy. It really is just a reiteration or an affirmation of what Kim has said.
And it's a reiteration and of statements, as you said, that have been going on for months now, with North Korea calling on the United States to change its tactics. And North Korea has also said that if the United States doesn't do that, it's going to go on a new path. But that seems to indicate it's going to go back to intercontinental ballistic missile tests, North Korea testing nuclear weapons. That's the old path, isn't it?
Really, exactly. I don't think there really is a new path. And even when some would argue that the Pyongyang policy of pursuing both military and economic priorities was a new path, in fact, Kim Jong-un had said that that was a continuation of a policy that his grandfather had made, the decision at a Central Committee meeting in 1962. So, you know, what's old is new again with North Korea. So now that North Korea is talking about going, you know, really returning to the old policy of threats and emphasizing, you know, in a way, the military-first policy of his father.
And you talk about returning. This seems to be another cyclical pattern where you have North Korea threatening to ratchet up tensions, eventually doing so, all calling for a removal of sanctions, the escalation of tensions, and then a lull again. And we've been in that lull for a little over a year now. Do you see any way to get out of this repeated cycle?
Not really. You know, North Korea is driven by its quest for a nuclear arsenal and the missile means to deliver them. And that started in the 1960s, and they really haven't swayed from that. They signed four international agreements promising never to build nuclear weapons, which they already were doing. So they cheated on those four, and then they signed four subsequent agreements promising to give up what they promised never to build in the first time. And then, you know, those agreements all collapsed. So North Korea alternates threats and provocations with charm offensives, though with North Korea it tends to be more offensive than charming. So throughout 2019, Kim Jong-un and North Korean officials were saying, our patience runs out at the end of the year. If the U.S. doesn't basically capitulate, then they will do, you know, dire though unspecified consequences. Things will become more dangerous, as Kim said. And so we're all waiting for some kind of provocation. Now, some thought it would happen on Christmas Day because a vice minister of foreign affairs said the Christmas present we get depends on our behavior. But, you know, that was more of a, I think, rhetorical flourish than a literal threat. So, you know, and also the end of the year deadline came and passed, and North Korea hasn't done anything yet, but they tend to do it in their own time. And perhaps one reason they're not doing anything yet is because Beijing and Moscow are still trying to push sanctions reduction through the UN Security Council. So North Korea may wait to see how that works out, and they don't want to undercut Chinese and Russian actions on their, you know, on their behalf. So if that peters out, or if
but don't you think it will peter out? Because I mean, when you talk about the UN Security Council, Russia, China, the United States are all, you know, permanent members with veto power, and it doesn't look like the United States would ever give up sanctions on North Korea without any kind of, you know, really intense movement along the denuclearization path.
Exactly. So at some point, either Russia and China will give up or North Korea will figure that it's not going anywhere. And then I would assume they'll do some kind of provocations. Right now we're really in deadlock, which is, you know, seemingly traditional on the Korean Peninsula, and we're all in a wait-and-see attitude for what Kim Jong-un does, you know, what he launches and how far it goes.
That was Bruce Klinger, Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation, speaking to me from his office here in Washington. The peculiar duck-billed mammal, Australia's platypus, is facing worsening conditions of a three-year drought, brush fires, land clearing, dam construction, and climate change. Conservation groups recently released footage of dead platypus that had died in drying riverbeds. Reuters reporter Libby Hogan has that story.
While the world has focused on koalas badly burned and killed in the Australian bushfires, one elusive mammal, the duck-billed platypus with webbed feet, is fighting for its existence. Australia has experienced prolonged drought, raging fires, and factors such as land clearing, dam construction, and climate change have provided challenging conditions for Australia's wildlife. Marine wildlife expert Richard Kingsford says it's a warning for protection efforts to be stepped up.
I'm not that pessimistic. I reckon, you know, this is just a wake-up call, I think. I'm really hopeful that governments and communities will get behind this and say, look, it's our responsibility. This is one of the most important species in the world. It's iconic. It's an egg-laying mammal, and we cannot even think about losing it.
Conservationists and rescuers have found some dead platypus in streams and rivers after the fires in recent months. Conservation group Aussie Ark has gathered video footage showing platypuses stranded and dying as their habitats dry out. The country has been ravaged by bushfires that have raised an area the size of a third of Germany since September. The platypus joins koalas and rock wallabies, also threatened by Australia's wildfires, which are deemed an ecological disaster.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan, and you're listening to VOA News.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A high-level panel on internal displacement established by the UN Secretary General says it will seek concrete long-term solutions to try to alleviate the plight of tens of millions of people internally displaced by conflict and natural disasters. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the panel discusses the many challenges facing them in the work that lies ahead.
The panel had its first brainstorming session Tuesday in preparation for the complex and challenging work that will get underway on February 26th. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has given the eight distinguished members of the high-level panel only 1 year to come up with a realistic plan to prevent displacement and mitigate its effects. Last year, the number of people internally displaced by conflict around the world reached a record high of more than 41 million. In the same year, the United Nations says 17 million other people were forced to move because of natural disasters and climate-related events. Panel co-chair Federica Mogherini is the former European Commission High Representative for Foreign Affairs and a seasoned politician. She says the panel will address the problem of displacement from many aspects. She says it will look for realistic, durable solutions and mobilize international support to help both the displaced and the countries hosting them.
The issue of internal displacement tends to be forgotten, while it is one of the major, not only humanitarian, but also, I would say, political crises that our times are seeing. So our first task will be to keep, or rather put, this as high as possible on the agenda and try to provide some good advices on how this can be addressed.
Co-chair Donald Kaburuka is a former president of the African Development Bank Group and Minister of Finance and Economic Planning in Rwanda. He says he hopes to bring his experience from the development world to find practical solutions to this problem. He tells VOA it is not possible to separate development, environment, and security, all elements involved in displacement.
We would be failing the Secretary General if we did not address the issue of climate impacts. I don't see any solution in the Sahel at the moment unless it encompassed what you're saying. What is happening to the climate and how it has metamorphosed into a social problem and now into a security problem. Those will have to be addressed together.
The panelists say they want a positive, productive outcome to the year-long deliberations. As such, they say they do not intend to point fingers of shame or dwell on governmental shortcomings. They will try to get states to work together to meet the needs of the displaced. They say they will try to avoid politicizing the issue. Rather, they will look at ways to help those forced to flee conflict and natural disasters live better under very difficult circumstances. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President Donald Trump touted the success of U.S. economy in Davos Tuesday, dismissing what he termed perennial prophets of doom on climate change to an audience that included Greta Thunberg.
This is not a time for pessimism. This is a time for optimism. Fear and doubt is not a good thought process, because this is a time for tremendous hope and joy and optimism and action.
With his impeachment trial beginning in Washington, Trump largely shied away from environmental issues, which are the top of the agenda at the gathering, the Swiss ski resort of business leaders for the annual meeting at the World Economic Forum. Trump said the U.S. would join an initiative to plant a trillion trees, but spent several minutes of his speech hailing the economic importance of the oil and gas industries. Trump did not refer directly to the teenage Swedish activist Thunberg, who responded to his speech by referring to empty words and promises from world leaders.
Planting trees is good, of course, but it's nowhere near enough of what is needed, and it cannot replace real mitigation and rewilding nature. Our house is still on fire. Your inaction is fueling the flames by the hour. And we are telling you to act as if you loved your children above all else.
In a wide-ranging address pitched to appeal to the Davos crowd, Trump said the U.S. was in a far better economic standing than he had imagined when he took office 3 years ago. Trump also praised Washington's relations with China, having recently signed a trade deal.
Today, I'm proud to declare that the United States is in the midst of an economic boom, the likes of which the world has never seen before.
It was the second time that Mr. Trump has taken the stage at the World Economic Forum. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Britain will put people before passports as he pledged a fairer migration system at an investment summit for African leaders in London on Monday. Britain wants to strike trade new deals with fast-growing economies in Africa and beyond after it officially leaves the European Union on January 31st. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, the turnout for the summit suggests muted enthusiasm among many African leaders.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson wooed African leaders gathered Monday in London with his now familiar message. Britain is going global after Brexit.
More than half the world's 15 fastest growing economies are in Africa.
Britain has some catching up to do. Annual two-way trade with Africa is around $46 billion, less than a quarter that of China, the continent's biggest trading partner. Prime Minister Johnson promised African citizens a fairer migration system with an end to free movement of EU citizens.
By putting people before passports, we will be able to attract the best talent from around the world, wherever they may be.
Johnson also pledged to end British investment in coal mining and coal-fired power plants overseas. So will Africa benefit from Brexit? Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, Mukisa Kituyi, told VOA it will take time.
For a long time to come, Europe is going to be the most important trading partner of Britain. Incrementally, embracing Africa is going to be fourth or fifth stage after more urgent priorities. So for Africa, the test of success in Britain opening up in a new relationship will be seen on whether they can make a better market access offer, capacity building offer, trade facilitation offer than what Africa receives under the Economic Partnership Agreement with Brussels.
The African leaders attended a reception at Buckingham Palace Monday evening as the royal family joined the charm offensive. But do African nations embrace the vision of a global Britain? 16 African leaders attended the London summit, far fewer than the number of leaders who attended similar recent events in Japan, Russia and China. The UN's Mukisa Kituyi says the world must respect Britain's democratic choice, but he says its presence will be missed in the EU.
Britain has been a voice of consensus building. It has been a voice of responsible engagement. That voice taken off the table leaves Brussels a poorer place. Secondly, I believe that the burden of transition is going to be higher in cost than the benefits of Brexit.
Britain has made its ambitions clear to strike out beyond Europe after Brexit, but by far the majority of economic forecasts, including the government's own analysis, show that leaving the world's biggest free trading bloc will likely slow Britain's economy for several years. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Now, ahead of the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz, survivors have been talking about their memories three quarters of a century on. Reuters' Joe Davies reports.
The hate of the past is forever spreading, like wildfire in the field. No lesson has been learned, and hate is on its stampede.
Tattooed on her arm, Vera Kriegel-Grossman still has the number to show for it. She's one of a dwindling number of people who survived the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. Age six, Vera and her twin sister were subjected to the pseudo-medical experiments of Dr. Joseph Mengele, his terrifying and grotesque practices earning him the name Angel of Death.
I won against all odds. I am here, look at me, I am here.
We filmed her as she told her stories to a group of guides from a Holocaust Memorial Museum. Stories of how she was kept naked in a cage, given painful injections into her spine, and stories of how she was beaten if she cried as she saw other children suffer and die. Many did. 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. 6 million Jews who never lived to provide first-hand testimony to the atrocities of the Nazis. 95-year-old Abraham Harshalom is another of the lucky few who did survive. And as the 75th anniversary of the camp's liberation approaches, he's keen that stories like his aren't forgotten.
In the first, let's say, 20 years after the war, all Holocaust survivors, and especially prisoners of Auschwitz, we are not talking at all, you know. We were not talking because people did not believe us that what we are selling is true. And second, they start to ask questions, listen, if it's everything so bad, how you survived? Where you see the white line,
On his arm, a scar where his prisoner number was tattooed before he had it removed. He now keeps it in a frame on a shelf in his living room.
My number, everyone was asking, what is it? They didn't know what it is, you know, a man with a number, you know. And then I decided, by the first possibility, to take out the number.
And that was Reuters reporter Joe Davies, and that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition of The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, thank you very much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.